You're listening to the Isaka Podcast. In this From Page to Podcast episode, we're speaking with Muhammad Khan, author of the Isaka Journal Volume 4 article, The Internet of Medical Things, Anticipating the Risk. In this episode, we're speaking about some of the cybersecurity concerns related to Internet of Medical Things, or IOMT, devices, many of which collect electronic personal health information. So to begin, can you tell us a little bit about how the risk associated with IOMT devices varies with regards to the stake and the type of information it collects as compared to other connected devices?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think just to kind of start off, whatever I say isn't a part of my company's direction or any thought that I present is really coming from my side. So I do think that the Internet of Anything, they've kind of evolved in many cases, and specifically to medical devices. I would say that the trajectory in terms of the number of devices that can be connected has become much easier. So if you take, for example, just the wearables that we have, 7 years ago, we didn't have wearable technology that was so intuitively connected to our internet services, but then more importantly, it's affordable. And it does provide a lot of advantages in terms of monitoring yourself. So if you correlate that with the medical devices industry, there's opportunity for not only the health practitioners, but also the patients and the people using the devices to be more proactive in terms of managing their health and not just leaving it to the health professional to deal with the actual patient's scenario.
Mm-hmm. And so if we have a listener who's maybe thinking about purchasing some kind of health management device or an activity tracker, what are some of the considerations they may want to make when either picking a particular product or even deciding if it's the device that they want to purchase?
Yeah, so this particular question, I think if you had to ask me the same question about maybe a leisure activity and you're trying to consider buying something, normally there's a choice. There's a choice for the consumer where I have a choice to buy it or not buy it, and my life will continue as it is. However, with medical devices, unfortunately, some of the devices are required just to make the life of somebody ease into what they do on a day-to-day basis, where you cannot, for example, opt out from purchasing something to manage your glucose levels, for example. And maybe you can live without it in terms of the glucose implantable, but it comes with a drawback. So what I'm trying to say here is that the bottom line is the patients normally don't have a choice sometimes. But if they do have a choice, I think it's important for patients to ask their health practitioners who they're working with in order to understand more about the device itself, what are some of the features, and more importantly, what are some of the data that it will connect with and collect and transfer it over to the health institution that you're working with. And then also, more importantly, what are the responsibilities not only of the patient, but then also the manufacturer that provides that service to the patient through the hospital system, let's say. So there's a lot of these questions, and most companies provide some sort of a good Q&A answer to these.
So that's an interesting point about patients talking to healthcare practitioners. So a lot of practitioners might not know about, you know, the security of a device or exactly how it works. So how can security professionals really work with health professionals to get them educated about what the devices do and how they work and just make sure they know exactly what they're providing or prescribing to their patients?
Yeah, I would say, based on my knowledge, most companies that offer medical devices, and especially the ones that are connected to the Internet of Things, they obviously make sure that the first and foremost aspect of keeping patients' health in the forefront of everything that they do. What that means is that safety of the patient itself. Now, not specifically talking about any medical device or company in general, I would probably say that the security professionals that are responsible for the device itself usually fall into the bucket of the institution that's creating this device itself. So normally companies have a security function within the manufacturing R&D space before something goes out to market, where they perform due diligence and review and verification and provide some sort of framework to ensure the cybersecurity principles are in place before it goes out to market. This is something that I think I believe companies are becoming more and more established in because it is a new area, especially with the connected devices. But then also if you correlate that with the pre- and post-market guidance that the FDA regulators have provided to the companies, it's also a good, I would say, a sign that things in the future will be much more mandated versus recommended. So I think that's not a quick answer to a broad question, but I think that's a starting point at least.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about breaches of personal health information. So can you tell us a little bit about the number? Do we see a lot of breaches of healthcare information? And what is it that makes that, you know, stealing this healthcare information so valuable to somebody who's trying to target it?
I think just generally speaking, if you look at all the breaches that do happen, putting a number behind it in terms of how much value does a data record have out in the black market, statistically and also from a study that many institutions have done, the healthcare records is probably the most lucrative for the black market because it does have a lot more value for the hackers out there selling the data once they obtain it. I do think that the breaches that are actually occurring, we hear a lot about that in the financial institutions, especially with aggregators of data companies where they plug in their services with a bigger, larger institution that collects data, for example. And there's always these breaches that you're hearing where it's not actually the big company that collects the data, but it's actually the smaller companies that somehow get access to that data. And then there's exposure to not only the small companies collecting this data, but then tied to the bigger company. Without naming names, I think most people would know what this is referring to. Now, the actual breaches that are happening year over year, it's increasing quite significantly. And the one of the reasons I believe this is happening is because of the fact that data sharing has become much more easier across companies, and part of it is because companies want to do the right thing with the data and provide more services, provide more products, but then if you don't put a proper framework around it and proper security mechanisms and controls, then there's always room for failure.
So in this podcast, we talk a lot about the risk associated with IoMT devices, but of course it can't be all bad. Can you tell us about some of the benefits that IoMT devices have?
I think some of the big benefits, they're pretty obvious. A more knowledgeable consumer or patient in this case, where they have the ability to monitor their own activity. So, for example, I have a it's not a medical device, but it's an activity tracker, for example, and it provides me some interesting details about, let's say, my experience, training for a marathon, and it's helped me get to a level where I could finish a marathon because there's a regimented training that I'm taking, and I can monitor it actively. Now, fortunately, I don't have any medical devices per se implanted or that I use. However, if you just simply look at the data points that a simple healthcare activity tracker, health activity tracker monitors, now you could imagine the amount of information a pacemaker might have, an insulin pump that is embedded into somebody's, not inside their body, but connected to their pancreas, for example, the amount of data that's being collected, and it provides the patient the ability to review what is happening to them, but then also provide those details to the health practitioner. I do think that what's really interesting is that most companies, the data is provided back to the patient in some sort of a user interaction through an app or other device. That data then could be used by the patient to take it to another healthcare practitioner and share that data. I think in the past it used to be collected by the the physician or the institution, and the patient wouldn't know what's happening. Now the data is something that they could actually obtain and provide to somebody else if they change service providers.
Your article mentions a lack of regulation when it comes to connected medical devices. What's the implication of this, and how can organizations go about configuring their medical devices in light of this lack of regulation?
Yeah, I think when you look at the regulatory landscape of cybersecurity for devices that are connected to the internet, that there's some strong guidance that is coming out, and that most of the time the FDA is kind of in the forefront because they're such a large body and they provide a lot of good insight, not only to the markets that the U.S. companies operate in, but then also the broader impact and implication it has on other regulatory bodies. So with that said, everybody's kind of pretty aware of the pre- and post-market guidance FDA had provided, which actually provides some assessment in terms of how to go about looking at cybersecurity controls and looking at what kind of framework to actually ensure they're embedded in terms of the design of the product and how to actually monitor the product's susceptibility to cybersecurity threat once it's out in the market. And they've highlighted NIST framework, for example, as a good way to ensure medical device manufacturers utilize for cybersecurity-related controls. So I do think that these regulatory bodies are going to get more stricter in terms of what are the requirements. But then part of it is also from an ISACA perspective, how do we ensure that these frameworks are then tying back to, let's say, COBIT, and ensuring that these type of mechanisms and frameworks are available for ISACA members, where they could also provide some of the clarity for their own industries. And it doesn't necessarily have to be medical devices per se. You could apply a lot of these controls that are actually coming from other institutions and industries. So financial banking, for example, a lot of the regulations that are embedded and enforced, a lot of the framework and controls are pretty similar to what you would need in other industries as well, like medical devices.
And so your article talks about the three classes of medical devices that there are. So what are those three classes? What are the risk levels associated with each class? And can you give us some examples of devices that fall into each class?
Generally, there's three classes that the FDA had highlighted in their actual classification of different medical devices. So they're pretty standard. You have class one, which is considered a low-risk class medical device, where it's usually consisting of lab equipment, analyzers, or chemical culture, things that necessarily do not directly impact a patient. So it's more of lab equipment that we're talking about here. And there's general controls that they do mandate apply to the systems and the body of products that are classed as this one. For class two specifically, they're right in the middle, where the risk is a little bit more in the medium or moderate level. And these specific products could be things like invasive surgical equipment, where you utilize clamps for surgery in the operating room, or certain ventilators or bone grafts that are utilized. And these devices itself are then left in, let's say, the patient's body. So these apply, this would apply for general controls, but then also special controls to these class of medical devices. And then the highest risk is the class three medical products, where this is where the devices are actually implantable devices, where there's some sort of an electromechanical mechanism embedded into the device. So some of the obvious examples could be the implantable pacemakers. And if you recall, the pacemakers are just really looking at the electrical flow within the heart, and it monitors and ensures that the heart's constantly beating at a certain rate. And these particular devices are the highest risk because it has a direct impact to the patient if there's a malfunction. And they do require pre-market approval from the FDA, and they have significant oversight from the FDA where the general controls apply, special controls apply. And then, as I was saying earlier, pre- and post-market guidance for cybersecurity would certainly apply to these type of devices.
And so then for our listeners, can you tell them a little bit about the kind of data that some of these wearables might capture, and then how those wearables would then potentially interact with hospitals or general physicians and then share that data?
Yeah, so I think the class 3 devices is where probably most of the data sharing probably occurs in terms of what's actually being collected. So if we look at certain implantables, whether it's brain neurotransmitters or insulin pumps or, you know, the heart pacemaker devices, each of these devices in some capacity or another collect data of the patient, patient's vitals, so glucose level, blood pressure, heartbeat, things of that nature. But then there's also some macro data and micro data that's being collected, which really help the practitioners and the institutions that collect this data to further understand and study how differentiations between one patient to another and the treatment and the efficacy of, let's say, the treatment plan is working out. So it basically provides healthcare practitioners and research institutions the ability to look at large sums of data and then somehow and one way or another improve their products, but then also improve the outcome and the life of the patient itself through having better products in the future, and then also increasing some of the functionality within the devices maybe through the use of this data. Now, the actual data that is collected, how is it valuable and beneficial for the patient? It's case by case, but I think I always go back to the simple terms of the more the patient knows about their own health, whether it's a device or not, it empowers the patient to actually become more aware of what's happening around them, especially with the device itself, giving them that ability to connect with all the data that they're actually producing. And this could be a conversation point with the physician and having a better perception of what's actually working or may not be working.
All right. And then your article outlines 4 different types of IOMT devices. Can you walk us through those different categories and give us some examples of them?
As far as medical devices are concerned, I think if we start from the bottom up, typically what we are seeing in the market is health monitoring devices, so active lifestyle, where essentially the device itself provides some basic vitals in terms of what your heart rate is, your respiratory rate or body temperature. And these are devices that are normally a watch or some sort of a wearable device that connects to your phone through a Bluetooth or Wi-Fi enabled application. And it essentially provides you some binary data that you could utilize for your own benefit or perhaps maybe share it with a group of people or your friends even, where it just kind of highlights your basics, right? So that's one category of it. Now, the other category, which is a little bit more, I would say, beneficial from a health perspective, is wearable medical devices. So the intent of these devices is really for, obviously, monitoring purposes, but then collecting data for further analysis by the healthcare providers themselves. So these could be your essential insulin pump device that's tied to your body to monitor your glucose levels, or electromechanical devices where potentially you're getting pain medication in small dosages through this device itself. There's also another set of devices that are your stationary medical devices. So stationary medical devices are, I would say, things like your ventilator, or if you're in a hospital and you have a pump infusing medication through your IV. Those devices could also be potentially connected to the hospital network or the ecosystem. And these devices kind of act the same way as a wearable medical device, but it provides the capability of Wi-Fi being enabled or not enabled. It does have data points that are being collected, and then whichever the system is that controls the data operates the data in a capacity that is in the means of the rightful use of the data, right? And then lastly, the implantable devices are devices that are actually within the body where a surgeon plants it into the patient. And these devices itself are, there's many of them out there now, and some of the essential and the common ones are the pacemakers and the insulin pumps, as well as neurotransmitters. So,
all right, so this is just kind of a question for, I guess, a little bit of speculation, but you talk about how medical devices such as pacemakers, insulin pumps, and MRI machines are increasingly vulnerable to hacking, and at the moment, there's really no U.S. federal mandate for these devices to have cybersecurity protections. Why do you think that is, and do you think that's something that may be changing and that in the future we will start seeing cybersecurity mandates around these kinds of devices?
I would say the regulation out there is becoming more stronger in terms of the data points that are out there with different companies and what companies are doing to better secure their products. One of the things I believe is happening in the industry is that the regulators want to see more innovation come out, but then with the innovation comes risk, and these risks are being addressed through different frameworks that companies are using, whether it's NIST or a certain offshoot of NIST, perhaps combining other different frameworks. And the guidance that the regulators are providing is assigned to state that these guidances will probably depict what will happen in the future in terms of ensuring these guidances are no longer a guidance but required. So I would probably say that the technology world has changed quite a bit, and the thing with connected devices is that you might have the best security on the device itself. However, when you plug that device into an ecosystem or a network that may be prone to vulnerabilities, it may become more likely for the device itself to get hacked because of the fact that you've put it inside an environment that is perhaps not the most secure. And you could find that example in most industries. So the way to really address this is to ensure that there's a framework being followed by not only the device maker, but also the institutions that are installing these devices and connecting it to their ecosystem to ensure proper controls are in place so that the devices are secured just as much as how your ecosystem of devices and your network itself is secured without the device.
And then is there anything else to add for our listeners that maybe you didn't get to discuss in your article or that has changed since the time that your article was written?
I do think that there's a lot of change happening in the industry, and especially with the cybersecurity threat where there's newer threats out there, but then the technology is also getting smarter, and there's a lot more people at the influential level where they do realize that there needs to be not only regulation, but then also innovation that needs to happen. One of the, I think, areas that we need to focus on as a whole is to have proper training and awareness, not only at the technologist level, but also at the executive level in terms of what is the pragmatic approach to some of this. And it's a learning experience, and it's a learning curve that everyone's going through. There's no right or wrong answer, but I feel like there needs to be some sort of an ability for companies to look at it in a pragmatic fashion and then ensure that there's some eyes and ears set on critical areas like this, which they are doing. It's just that you want to make sure that there's a little bit more of a framework behind it, and it's not a one-off thing and you check the box and you move on, but it's a continuing and evolving space. So I think as an auditor, you always have to also think about the future and things that are changing the landscape, and this could be one of those areas where if us as auditors are not ahead of the curve, we won't be able to provide our insight back to the institutions that we work in. So I would probably say learning more and reading more about this will continue, and that's certainly a key takeaway for me.
Thanks, Mohammed. And that's all we have time for in this episode of the podcast, but if you're interested in learning more, read Mohammed Khan's Isaka Journal Volume 4 article, The Internet of Medical Things, Anticipating the Risk.